President Trump visits a Marine Air Station in Yuma, Arizona today before that rally in Phoenix tonight. And as we said last night, he announced he will recommit the U.S. to the war in Afghanistan.
My original instinct was to pull out. And historically, I like following my instincts. But all my life, I've heard that decisions are much different when you sit behind the desk in the Oval Office. In other words, when you're president of the United States.
Senior U.S. officials say part of the plan, around 4,000 more troops in Afghanistan. The president said he'll put more pressure on Pakistan, long a safe haven for the Taliban. And he invoked India, Pakistan's nuclear rival. We've looked at this from a political perspective, now a military one. Retired Admiral James Stavridis is former Supreme Allied Commander at NATO. He's now dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts. Admiral Stavridis, your thoughts on what you heard last night?
The president had three bad options in front of him. First of all, he could cut our losses and run after 2,400 dead and $800 billion spent. And we would have ended up, Robin, with helicopters lifting off the roof of the American embassy, much like we saw at the end of the war in Vietnam.
Because of what? Let's remind people of that image in Vietnam. That was Vietnamese begging the U.S. to bring them out with them.
Indeed. And I think you would see the descent to chaos that we saw in Vietnam and the need for humanitarian withdrawal completely. So bad option. Second option the president had, go back to the big force. When I was NATO commander, I had 150,000 troops under my command in Afghanistan. That is an option for which nobody has an appetite. There's enormous Afghan fatigue. So you're left with that kind of middle option, which is minimalist. It increases troops by a tiny number, 4,000. We need to press our allies to match that. That'll give us an extra 8,000. And use the other tools that we have, putting pressure on Pakistan, working to build an Afghan air force. There are tactical things we can do. But it's a bad option, but it's the least worst option the president was presented with.
It seems to be also the option that the U.S. has had for a while now. In other words, what he announced last night is pretty much a continuation of U.S. policy.
Robin, I've been calling it kind of back to the future, and I feel like we are now roughly where we were back in 2013 as we drew down from the 150,000 troops to the current number, somewhere around 12,000 total, U.S. and allied. So it is very much what we've done in the past. The only two new elements are, first, the idea that this will be conditions-based, not timeline-based. In other words, telling the Afghans and particularly the Taliban we are going to stay. And then secondly, the idea of bringing India into the mix to try and put pressure on Pakistan. That's a fairly new idea. I think those two things will have a small effect, but we're not looking at a game changer here, but we can at least stay in the game.
Well, by the way, so just to go over some of the things we just said, there are now about 8,800 U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan, about 3,300 of them are believed to be special ops. And there's another, as you said, almost, 6,500 allied and NATO troops.
Correct.
And so with the president's talk in the past of adding about 4,000, maybe we double the amount of U.S. troops who are there, but it's still far less than the 150,000. Wow, it's hard to remember that were there at one time. But talk more about India. How does India put pressure on Pakistan, which is thought to be supporting the Taliban in Afghanistan, if not subtly undermining the fight against the Taliban?
As you well know, India and Pakistan have been locked into a decades-long geopolitical rivalry. The idea that we can approach India and then say to Pakistan, do not step across this line of support to the Taliban, or we will put even more support and engagement with your arch-rival India, is the theory of the case. Whether that works or not is another story. It's going to be a very delicate diplomatic dance.
Well, it's interesting you say this, because this is some of your same thinking about North Korea, and we want to get to that in a second. But before we leave Afghanistan, what's endgame there? The Soviet Union was taken down in part because of its determination to take down Afghanistan. What happens to Afghanistan?
I think the best possible outcome we could achieve would be the following. A democracy, a nation that has minimalist but some control over its borders, keeping the Taliban out of the major population centers, and over time, a political diplomatic solution that brings the Taliban into a conversation about peace in Afghanistan better than it is now. And the increase of troops at least allows us to move in some measure toward that outcome.
It sounds as if your vision of Afghanistan for the foreseeable future is a country that's pretty much, I hate to put it this way, but babysat by U.S. and international troops.
Well, one man's or one woman's babysitter is another person's ongoing engagement. Let's recall we still have 60,000 troops in Europe since the end of the Second World War. We have 30,000 troops in Korea. I don't think it's exactly babysitting, but I think it is ongoing engagement.
Right.
And I think you can make, again, a minimal case for doing so in Afghanistan. Again, these are all bad options.
Right. And sure. And, you know, that's probably a terrible metaphor because it's a very, you know, people die in Afghanistan still. But in other words, they need engagement for the foreseeable future. Some people are hearing the part of the speech where President Trump said that this was going against his instincts to, instead of pulling out of Afghanistan, send some more troops. Some are seeing that as setting up his generals in case there is failure. In other words, being able to say down the road, I didn't really want to do this. What did you think of that language?
At the end of the day, the buck stops with the President of the United States, and he will own this war going forward.
Let's go to North Korea. You presented a 10-point plan. We'll post it at herenow.org. Things like increased intelligence and surveillance of North Korea, even though, as you point out, there's limited intelligence assets, limited, you know, satellites, but focus more of them on the North Korea, increase our missile defenses, but also take counsel with South Korea more and build a regional approach. Talk more about that regional approach, which you also just described in Afghanistan.
What we need to do, first of all, before we even get to the regional approach, is spend more time talking to our South Korean allies. They are our best source of information, and I would argue generally our best counselors in how to deal with the North. Then you build out from there, Robin, and that means getting Japan, most notably, but also Australia, New Zealand, Malaysia, Vietnam. We need to get this out of a conversation where it is today of the U.S. versus North Korea and get it into a conversation of the international community and especially the region against North Korea.
Well, and that brings us to China. And you say, of course, China is imperative, but we're never going to get China on our side fully, make them actually walk the walk, not just talk it, without making clear we don't intend to change the regime in North Korea or unify the Korean Peninsula. Talk more about what that means to China.
China wants Kim Jong-un to remain in power. They want the regime to continue because they want a reliable partner. On the other hand, they don't want this to break down into fire and fury, as President Trump pointed out to us. So I think for China, it's a narrow game to find a way to pull back North Korea, put the leash on Kim Jong-un. Think of Kim Jong-un as an aggressive, angry dog. China's got it on a leash. That's good. But if the dog bites somebody, the dog is going to get put down. That's a very bad outcome for China. We can leverage that to get Chinese engagement.
Well, Admiral, a couple things. First of all, you say we need to convince Kim as well that our goal is not to remove him because he's thinking of Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, who were removed. We have to convince him there. But the language that you just used, you know, you have cautioned against that kind of language. In fact, you write, we need to look to the masterpiece of leadership literature. I'm referring, of course, to Mario Puzo's The Godfather, because Don Corleone tells us not to make the mistake of hating our enemies with blind emotion. So the fire and fury comments, maybe the dog, you say that's just not productive.
I think it's unhelpful. Yeah. And the language that we ought to focus on is that used by Secretary of Defense General Jim Mattis. And it's a lot more Cool Hand Luke and a lot less George Patton.
But for those who don't get the Cool Hand Luke, the toughest words in that film that were spoken, I think, were, what we have here is a failure to communicate.
Exactly. And I think that is the approach we need to take. And I think we can get there with China. And again, I wouldn't want to see any kind of inflammatory talk from our president, because that rhetoric at that level has real impact in ways that will push Kim away from a reasonable solution.
Well, and you say it also clouds your own judgment, the judgment of the person saying it.
It did.
Yeah. Retired Admiral James Stavridis, Dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts and former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, overseeing over 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. Admiral, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin.